The rest of us, we continue as we have been exploring this thing called prayer, but even more than that, or we could say underneath that, or even a little bit deeper, we continue to seek really after what is the way of Jesus, right? To answer his call, lech acharai, come follow, be my disciple. Keeping in mind that the call of Jesus has never been a call to Christianity, it's never been a call to be a Christian. It has always been to come follow. Follow me. Follow me in my way of being in the world. Follow me in my way of doing life. Right? My posture, my attitude, my activity to follow in the way of. Noting, as we have, that Jesus is one who prays. And consequently, then, we too are called to be a people who pray, to follow in the way of the one who prays. And then with that, we've been then considering prayer as it was in Jesus' day, and then in that then to kind of pursue his practice of prayer. Pursue his practice of prayer, not so much or not simply using words, right? Not simply as words to be spoken, but there is that, absolutely. Not necessarily as words simply to be recited, but even more than that, not just what we say, but it's what we do. It's what we do. It's to be lived out. Keeping in mind that Jesus, right, at the backdrop of his life was this prayer that we have been working our way through, this prayer called the Amidah. The Amidah being at the heart of Jewish liturgy both today and dating all the way back to the 5th century BC, where again, as Jewish tradition tells us, the men of the great assembly gathered together, 120 men in all, Ezra, Nehemiah, Mordecai, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, good names, right? 120 in all, gathering together, providing leadership. One objective, 4 tasks, one of which was the institution of prayer. Keeping in mind that at this particular time in history, you had many Jews that had been exiled to Babylon. You had the destruction of the temple. And so it was a time of great disorientation and disconnection. And so in part, the men of the great assembly gathered together, instituting this prayer, standardizing, we could say, the language of prayer as a way to bring unity to a people. The central prayer being, again, the Amidah, Shemona Esrei, Hatfilah, right? What is a prayer that no doubt Jesus would have recited, but even more than that, again, it's a prayer that he lived out, and we see that reality again today as we turn to what is now the 12th blessing. We're kind of working back to the 12th blessing, I guess we could say. What is interesting here, there's a bit of irony, what is interesting is that this particular blessing was not part of the Amidah during the life of Jesus. So this would have not been part of the Shemona Esrei, means 18, there were 18 blessings. This one was added following the put down of the Jewish revolt in AD 70 and the destruction of the Second Temple, all by the Roman Empire. And so this was not actually one of the original 18. It was at one point put in as the 19th and then got moved up to the 12th. But there's a bit of irony here that I want us to kind of flesh out today. Noticing the language here from the 12th blessing, we read, "And let there be no hope for slanderers, and let all wickedness perish in a moment, and let all your enemies be swiftly cut off and quickly uproot the dominion of arrogance, crushing, reducing, and humbling it in our day. Blessed are you, Lord," that's Adonai in the Hebrew, meaning God, so referring to God. "Blessed are you, God, who breaks your enemies," and then we read, "and humbles the arrogant." And according to the Talmud, and more specifically, Brachot 28b, Talmud being that compilation of oral law or oral Torah, this blessing, as author John Parsons puts it, This blessing was used as a sort of litmus test by the rabbinics, seeing it as a curse on followers of Yeshua, and think Jesus, of Yeshua, the Messiah. And so what is interesting here is that this particular 12th blessing that speaks of humility, right? Uproot the dominion of arrogance, humbling it. Blessed are you, God, right? Who humbles the arrogant. And what is interesting is that this blessing speaks of humility and as is instituted as kind of a pushback by the Pharisees against followers of Jesus. And yet it is Jesus who demonstrates for us the ultimate act of humility. The Apostle Paul, in writing to followers of Jesus in the Greek city of Philippi, he picks up on this, chapter 2 and verse 5. We read there, in your relationships with one another, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, it says he made himself nothing. This is not on the screen, but that word nothing, kno, in the Greek. And it literally means to divest or to rid yourself of power and position and prestige. In other words, to humble yourself. Right? In fact, it can be translated to humble yourself, right? He made himself nothing. He humbled himself. And how? It's interesting, Paul says, by taking the very nature of a servant. By taking the very nature of a servant, doulos, in the Greek. What is a word that we find all over the Gospels? It's a word we find in virtually every New Testament letter. And it's the word that is most used to describe followers of Jesus in the first century. Notably, it's Paul himself who describes his relationship with Jesus as a servant, as a doulos. From Galatians, opening chapter, verse 10, am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Or am I trying to please people? If I were still trying to please people, I would not be a servant, a doulos of Christ. We find it in Romans, right here, Paul, right out of the gate, his very first words, Paul, a doulos of Christ Jesus. 2 Corinthians 4 and 5, again, Paul, this is Paul speaking, for what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves, here he says, as your servants. Right, the relationship Paul has with Jesus, he's his doulos. Right, and here he says, I'm your servant. I'm your servant. Right, your doulos for Jesus' sake. Timothy, he makes this same sort of remark regarding doulos. 2 Timothy, 2 Timothy 2 and 24, and the Lord's doulos must not be quarrelsome, but must be kind to everyone. But not only Paul, let's go on. The Apostle Peter, 1 Peter 2 and 16, he writes, live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Instead, live as God's doulos. And then in 2 Peter, opening line, Simon Peter, and what does he call himself? He says, I'm a doulos, a servant of Jesus. Then there is Jude, a servant, a doulos of Jesus Christ. And then there is James, the brother of Jesus, a leader in the early church. And how does he describe himself? Interesting, he doesn't describe himself as a brother or as a sibling or as a family member, right? But James, a servant, a doulos of God and Jesus. But not just the New Testament. We can go back to the ancient Hebrew scriptures. Over 1,000 times we read Ebed. It's the word used to describe those like Abraham and Jacob and Joshua and Hannah and Ruth. We could go on and on. Ebed is used, I think, over 40 times to describe Moses. King David, we see it more than 50. Noting that at the very center of their humility is above all this way of a servant. For more on that, I want us to look at two illustrations today. Just really quickly, two illustrations. If you want to grab a Pew Bible, you can. Page 716. We're going to be looking at Mark 10:32 to begin with. The words will be on the screen behind me as well. But really, two illustrations of this way of humility, traveling the path of a servant. And in Mark 10, verse 32, it's there we read that they, meaning Jesus and his disciples, were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus, it says, leading the way, which I think is beautiful, right? It's not that he tells them what to do, right? He's doing it. It's not that he tells them where to go. The text says he's leading the way. In the words of the New Testament scholar Edward Schweitzer, here is the master who goes before his disciples, whose responsibility it is to follow him. When it comes to humility and suffering, Jesus not only teaches, he leads the way. And so here they are. They're on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. And then again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. Incidentally, this is the third time that he's sharing this. This is probably the more explicit of the three. Verse 33, we're going up to Jerusalem, he said, and the Son of Man, meaning himself, Jesus, will be delivered over to the chief priests, the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. Now, contextually here, Jesus has been spending a lot of time with his disciples. He's been getting them away, getting them kind of alone, primarily because they're not getting it. Primarily because their paradigm, their worldview, the way that they live and move and breathe was not in line with the way of Jesus, was not in line with the way of the kingdom. Many, if not most, Jews had been exiled. And so you had many, again, that were hoping, waiting, longing for a Joshua-like military figure to come and to free them from the oppression. Right? They were under the thumb of the Roman Empire. And so for many Jews, this was their hope, this was their dream, that there would be this Messiah that would come and free them, as Timothy Keller puts it into perspective for us. He writes, from his mother's knee, Peter, and we can easily imagine the other disciples as well, had always been told that when the Messiah came, he would defeat evil and justice by ascending the throne. And so for Peter and for the others, right, they've been waiting for the one who would come and would overthrow their enemies, for the one who would release them from their oppressors, who would liberate them from the Roman Empire. And along with that, who would elevate their status, who would elevate their power and their position and their prestige. But then here is Jesus saying, right, we're going to Jerusalem, right? But he's talking about suffering and rejection. He's talking about being mocked and spit upon and being handed over, which is a very different paradigm from what was sort of the standard Jewish cultural mindset. As one scholar puts it, he says the kind of Messiah they want will never come. They are determined to find a compliant Superman who is endowed with heavenly powers and will fulfill their own earthly program, the Messiah of their dreams. And then as if that just went straight over their heads, verse 36, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. From the scholar Edwards, the request of James and John is the third and most blatant example of self-centeredness in contrast to Jesus' humility and self-sacrifice. They're asking Jesus to sign a blank check is even more elitist than the statement of the Apostle John in 9:38. It is self-serving, callous toward Jesus, and an offense to their comrades. Verse 36, what do you want me to do for you? They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in glory. And so here is Jesus, right? He's leading them. He's going before them. He's speaking of suffering and rejection, right, of being mocked and spit upon. He's talking about being condemned to death. Right, in vivid detail, Jesus predicts his death here, and once again, the disciples are speaking of greatness and glory. In Jewish custom, writes Edwards, the place of highest honor was at the center of the company, followed by the right and left hands, respectively. Rabbinic writings frequently comment on the seating order in paradise and argue that the just would sit nearer to the throne of God than even the angels. Their preoccupation with rank and standing is in character with what we know of Judaism. According to the Talmud, we read there, three walking along, the teacher should walk in the middle, the greater of his disciples to his right, the smaller one at his left. And then it goes on to say, and thus do we find that of the three angels who came to visit Abraham, Michael went in the middle, Gabriel at his right, Raphael at his left. Verse 41, when the ten heard about this, they became indignant. That's agonakteo, means to be irate or incensed, think furious, offended. They became indignant with James and John, but not because they understood, right? Not because they were full of this maybe deeper humility. But as the scholar David Garland says, they are angry because James and John beat them to the punch and may now have an edge over them for the power slots. Jealousy creates turmoil in the ranks. The disciples would rather bear a grudge than a cross. And so again, Jesus gathers his disciples, right, his followers together. And in verse 42, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them, not so with you. Instead, and here's where we get it. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your diakonos, another word for servant, must be your diakonos, and whoever wants to be first must be doulos of all. Right? It's like Jesus is saying, you want to be first, then become as the last. You want to be the best, become as the least. You want to be the greatest, become a servant. Become a servant of all. Right, in a word, to live the way of humility. To live this way of humility, he made himself nothing, right? He humbled himself, Paul says, by taking the very nature of a doulos. One more, page 763, if you want to turn there. We'll close with this one, John chapter 13. This is a Thursday night. The disciples, they're all there. They've gathered with Jesus. They're having a meal together. And in John 13 and verse 4, we read, so he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. And then dropping down to 12, when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes, returned to his place. Do you understand what I have done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. For truly I tell you, no doulos is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, and then he gives his own blessing. You will be blessed, he says, if you do them. Now in those days, foot washing was, we could say, common. It was something that was done, maybe especially when you're gathering around a communal table and reclining where feet are in good view. But right, we think of Palestine dry and dusty or muddy by the rain. And so when you left your home, maybe you had clean feet, but by the time you got where you were going, not so much. And so it was common in those days, but what was not common was that a host would wash the feet of his guests. Right? That was the work, that was the job of a doulos. Right? And so this story, it is not that somebody would wash feet, but that Jesus is the one that is doing it. Again, verse 12, when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes, returned to his place. Do you understand what I have done for you? He asked them. All right, he gets to the end of the foot washing and he says, do you understand what I have done for you? Right, he wasn't just simply washing their feet. In a sense, he was saying, this is who I am. And maybe with that, this is who you are to be. Right, now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. He made himself nothing. He humbled himself by taking the very nature of a servant, a doulos, which I think invites us to consider then, is that true for us? Is that true for you and me? In our relationships, do we take on the nature of a servant? In our relationships, in this room, in our homes, in our workplaces, in our communities, our neighborhoods, in our relationships, do we take on the nature of a servant? To kind of get at that, we could ask, do we identify ourselves foremost as doulos? Remember, doulos is used more than any other word to describe those followers of Jesus. Do we identify ourselves above all else as doulos? When somebody says to you, tell me a little bit about yourself, is doulos at the top of the list? And notice, Paul, but not only Paul, James, Jude, John, right? None of them begins identifying themselves by, you know, I'm a carpenter or I'm a fisherman. They don't begin with, I'm a male or a female. They don't begin with, I'm rich or I'm poor. They don't begin with, I'm a Democrat or a Republican. Right? That's not, they begin with doulos. At the very heart and center of their identity. Do we identify ourselves as doulos? We could ask, is the way of a doulos at the center of your identity? Right? The core of who you are. With that, we could simply ask in our relationships, do we live this way of humility? Right? He made himself nothing. Do we live this way of humility? Do I make myself nothing? Divest? Do I rid myself of all power and position and prestige? Do we walk this way of humility? And then kind of maybe wrapping it up, we could then go on to the second example there and say, what would it look like for you, for me, to be a foot washer? What would it look like for us to be washers of feet? Keeping in mind that in our context, to be a foot washer is to see a need and then move to meet that need. Right? This is not about washing feet. Let's not mistake that. Jesus is not saying, okay, get around and get in a circle and wash one another's feet. If we do that, we're missing the point. It's about seeing a need and then moving to meet that need. Jesus is not instituting another sacrament, right, where we all get together and wash feet. In fact, I think he would be sad, maybe even hurt and burdened, if we decided gathering together and washing feet was the thing to do instead of feeding the poor, water for the thirsty, food for the hungry, those in the margins. This is not about foot washing. The point is an attitude of humility that's then offered through an act of service. And so really, I think of washing feet, the deeper point being maybe washing feet might look like maybe sending a note of encouragement to a single mom. More than that, you call that single mom and say, I'm going to the grocery store. I know you've got a lot going on. Let me pick up some stuff for you while I'm there. I'll drop it by on my way home. Maybe washing feet, maybe it might look like, you know, volunteering at the food share pantry. Maybe it might look like spending a Saturday afternoon with someone who you know is struggling. What would it look like for you, for me, for us to be foot washers? And then with that, we could ask, Lord, whose feet would you have me wash this week? Whose feet would you have me wash today? Whose feet would you have me wash this week, this month? The Amidah speaks of humility. Jesus absolutely lives the way of humility, and he calls us to do the same, to live the same. He made himself nothing, right? He humbled himself by taking the very nature of a doulos.